Okay, let's hear now about an aspiring startup. It's called Blue Box Now. The young company claims to be revolutionizing how companies market to their customers. Like entrepreneurs everywhere, the founders of Blue Box Now really want to make it big. And over the next year or so, Morning Edition will follow them as they try to improve their product, win over customers, and bring in revenue. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman has our first report.
Earlier this year, the founders of Blue Box Now, guys in their 30s and 40s, were faced with a choice. The company they were working for was bought out, and they had to decide what to do next.
I had applied for a job at Microsoft, and I was offered the position.
That's Craig Gunther Lee. Today, he's the creative director at Blue Box Now. But a few months ago, he was mulling an offer with a six-figure salary.
I was like, hey, you know, do I want to go ahead and take this kind of safe, secure job, which, you know, would have been great for my family. But I was really ready to launch into something else. And we've worked really well together as a team. And I thought that together we could do something extremely exciting.
Chad Reed and Naresh Dhiman, the company's other co-founders, thought the same thing. They collectively ponied up about $50,000 and a company was born. Reed, the chief marketing officer, started his career as a cabana boy. The one-time college quarterback spent years as a brand manager for the beverage company Red Bull. Dhiman, the company's CEO, is a veteran software architect.
15 years back, I started a small company in India.
And moved to the U.S. during the dot-com era. Introducing himself to a group of entrepreneurs recently, he remarked he'd made a big mistake by turning down a chance to join Google in the late 1990s.
Besides that, I played every game possible in the world, and every game I got injured. I played soccer, I got injured badly. I started ping pong, I got injured in that too. Then I started playing poker with my wife, I got injured in that too.
Fortunately for him, his wife fully supports his new venture. The startup hopes to dramatically change how companies target their customers through marketing. Chad Reed explains that with Blue Box Now, restaurants, hotel chains, department stores, and others could integrate the email data they already have about their customers with information about those individuals that's posted online.
We know that this is something that they could absolutely use.
And the team got a big vote of confidence earlier this summer when it was chosen for a highly selective tech incubator program.
My name is Andy Sack, and I'm managing director of Techstar Seattle. Today is orientation day. 10 companies are arriving, and the program runs for 3 months and culminates in demo day on November 3rd.
Chad Reed with Blue Box Now. Very excited to be here. I mean, you see all this brain power in this one, I guess we're down in a basement. There's a lot of testosterone in here.
Techstar Seattle is one of a number of tech incubators. Typically, they provide a small amount of funding, in this case $18,000, in exchange for a small equity stake. As part of the program, the guys from Blue Box Now meet with technology experts, marketing gurus, venture capitalists, and others. CEO Naresh Dhiman says the constant feedback has been extremely valuable.
Best thing is the mentors. They give feedback, and they are very clear, and they are very consistent also.
The company had been struggling with how to describe its product and pitch it to potential clients. Dhiman says the team had been focusing on what the product was. But after talking to mentors and others, they shifted their pitch to why clients need it.
And that's a very, very different perspective. And it is very impact-making.
Dhiman says prospective clients view what they're selling with more interest now. But he acknowledges that altering their approach has cost them time, so have communication problems with India-based software coders and the decision to make their product more sophisticated than originally planned.
The whole principle of startup is learn. Deliver the small chunk of product and learn from feedback how you want to change it.
The company is now running 2 months behind schedule, and the revenue the founders had hoped to see hasn't materialized yet. They're beginning to feel the pinch. Dhiman is currently without health insurance. Gunther Lee has taken on some freelance work, and Chad Reed is hoping he doesn't have to ask his family for a loan. They all remain optimistic about the company's future, but as Reed and Gunther Lee describe it, it's been a bumpy ride.
One day that you're going to be up on cloud nine, and the next day you're like, oh, God, this is just a shot to the gut.
Yeah, I think that's part of the startup roller coaster, is just that huge up and down. And, you know, you just ride the peaks and the valleys and just go with it, you know.
Blue Box Now has landed its first paying client, and the first marketing campaign is slated for next month. Only then will the startup begin to discover if it can deliver on its promise to help companies target their customers more effectively. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
And as we said, we'll be checking in on Blue Box Now over the next year or so to find out what happens.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Slowing down climate change could well require a major change in human behavior, a wholesale shift away from fossil fuels. But there's hope that technology can help us along that road. NPR's Richard Harris introduces us to one man who is developing a way to suck carbon dioxide right out of the air.
David Keith is a bit fidgety. Maybe that's because venture capitalists have asked to come see his carbon dioxide machine. Maybe it's because the project is running months behind schedule, as experiments so often do. Maybe it's because his critics say it'll never work. Or maybe it's a taste of excitement because it seems entirely possible that the trailer truck-sized machine that he's leaning up against is actually going to work.
It's amazing to see all this talk and paper get turned into hardware. I really love it.
Keith is on a patch of blacktop on a campus of the University of Calgary in Alberta, where until very recently he's been a professor. Now his academic hat is Harvard, where he is both a professor of public policy and a professor of applied physics. His hard hat is a little startup company called Carbon Engineering, housed on the Calgary campus. And that company is building a machine that can actually suck carbon dioxide from the air.
So you're tempted in telling a story to say this is like a test. Can we take CO2 out of the air? But people have done this for a long time. There were commercial processes that took CO2 out of the air, in fact, in the 1950s. So there's no mystery that we can do it.
But those companies were just extracting small quantities of carbon dioxide for industrial purposes. Keith is after a much more important question, one that is universal for anyone trying to develop a technology. And that is whether he can do it affordably and on a grand scale.
So our interest is in building full-scale commercial systems that would take tens of thousands or more tons of CO2 a year out of the air.
Taking on climate change is in part personal for Keith. This wiry man has skied across many hundreds of miles of the rapidly melting Arctic, so he knows more than most people what's at stake. Getting this project to work is also an intellectual challenge.
It's fun to go after problems where there's a wide public consensus in one direction that is sort of thin, where people haven't thought about it very much. And I think on this topic, there's a lot of my colleagues who are experts in energy technology would say that it's a total joke to take CO2 out of the air and it must cost thousands of dollars a ton carbon. And when we began looking hard at it, we became convinced that that really wasn't right and that it's not that other people are fools, it's just that people haven't taken the time to actually do the engineering. And when you do the engineering, you find it's not as hard as you think.
As he looks at the machine taking shape, he points out that all of its components are tried and true technology, just reassembled in a novel way for a novel result. If scaled-up versions of this contraption can work, capturing carbon from the air could alleviate one of the biggest challenges in climate change.
It provides a route to manage emissions from transportation. Transportation needs high energy density fuels like hydrocarbons. It's very hard to replace those with batteries, and in some places, like airplanes, you just can't.
David Keith's gift as both an energy analyst and an engineer is that he thinks about problems in unconventional ways. So, on the one hand, Keith faces skepticism from his friends in academia. But some very smart people are betting big money that he's right. Bill Gates turns to David Keith for advice on matters of energy and climate. And Gates and a Canadian billionaire have given him $6 million to put his ideas to the test.
It's sort of only possible by forming a company to actually answer the question of what it really costs to do this.
We're going to be bump testing these fans right behind you there.
Oh, I can't wait.
The 600-volt power line is switched on, and the machine shows its first sign of life as they put power to one key component, the fans that suck the air through this apparatus.
It's going to be loud.
Well, one of them's spinning.
These fans will draw air through a 31-foot-long chamber filled with wavy plastic material. Water laced with sodium hydroxide will run down that plastic and will react with carbon dioxide to pull it out of the air. After that part of the machine is up and running reliably, Keith plans to test various chemical systems to complete the process. That is, to recycle the chemical that captures carbon dioxide and to create a pure stream of CO2 gas, which can then be buried underground.
Going in the right direction, that's for sure.
The right direction.
Keith sees a few niche applications that could actually make this little company money. One idea is to take the pure carbon dioxide and pump it underground to push up oil. He says this oil would qualify as a low-carbon fuel, since producing it would actually take carbon dioxide out of the air.
We think we could make hydrocarbon fuels that had substantially lower life cycle carbon emissions than conventional gasoline. And that is both, I think, genuinely important for the environment and also potentially lucrative under the emerging standards for low-carbon fuels like the California low-carbon fuel standard.
And that's where the venture capitalists come in. The following day, two guys in business suits show up from Chrysalix, one of the biggest venture capital companies focused on clean energy.
So what's the testing program? Is this supposed to run 24/7 continuous?
24/7 continuous once we get going. I mean, obviously there's a whole
David Keith shows them around his equipment. They ask lots of questions. And in the end, Chrysalis CFO Mike Walkinshaw nods his head approvingly.
We think there's a great business opportunity in solving the world's global warming issues. I think that the problem will become more manifest over the next few years, and that the world's going to be looking for answers, and they're going to be willing to pay for it.
Hmm. And does it give you comfort to actually see bent metal and pipes and all the rest of the stuff when you're thinking about what to invest in? I mean, here's obviously, this is more than just an academic idea at this stage.
Yeah, we love prototypes. Yeah, it's excellent work that Professor Keith has been doing here.
This is not the only small company exploring air capture of carbon dioxide, but with costs so high at the moment, it's at best a distant dream to scale it up enough to affect the global climate. David Keith agrees with his critics on that point, but Keith says costs will never come down and technology will never advance unless there's someone at the edge pushing forward.
I've spent 20 years of my life trying to figure out how to help solve the climate problem, and I work on lots of different technologies, so I don't believe any one of them is any kind of silver bullet, but I do believe we need to have a larger set of potential solutions to deal with a climate problem, none of which will be perfect, none of which we understand very well, but we do a better job if we have more options on the table.
And now, several weeks after that interview, Keith reports that the machine is up and operating. The technical problems that some critics thought could be showstoppers have not materialized, he says. Now the challenge is to squeeze in as much testing time as they can before Calgary's winter weather moves in and shuts them down for the season. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. Senator Barbara Mikulski summed up the situation on Capitol Hill. After her science subcommittee agreed to cut the National Science Foundation's budget by 2.5%, she said, "For the first time as chair, I've eliminated programs." Writing this week in an editorial in the journal Science, Congressman Rush Holt argues that the government is in danger of heading down the wrong path with regard to science funding, that spending on science is as important as is very important part of our nation's future. Rush Holt from New Jersey is one of the few scientists in Congress, former director of the Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, and he joins us once again on Science Friday. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Were you surprised at what Senator Mikulski said and your editorial? I mean, the alarm bells are going off.
Well, I mean, no, I'm not surprised. I mean, this year, all the talk in Washington has been about cutting. That's been the debate. And so the debt ceiling deal that was reached in early August was about what kind of automatic pilot we would put the country on there. And then there was this super 12-member committee that was created. And most of the discussion around that was about cutting. Now, it wasn't specifically about cutting research and science, but we do know that since the 1960s, R&D has fallen by nearly two-thirds. And, you know, whether you're talking about measuring that as a percentage of discretionary spending or as a percentage of the gross domestic product, R&D has taken a hit over the years. And now when there are going to be, if all of this goes forward as planned, huge government cuts in government spending, federal support for R&D is certain to take serious hits.
Do you feel that this Congress is even more critical of science and more willing to cut R&D than other sessions?
You know, and they don't even think of it as an attack on science. They're not so much critical of science. It's a kind of pessimism that has set in that leaves science vulnerable. You know, for 200 years, Americans have always said the next generation will be better than the current generation because we will make it so. Investment in research, maybe back in the 19th century you didn't call it research, but investment in this kind of infrastructure and intellectual infrastructure that allows this growth and progress has been part of the American way. And the debate this year has been a much more pessimistic debate, saying we'll just have to regret that the next generation is not going to be better than this generation. So instead of saying we're going to make it so, we're going to lament the fact that it isn't so and say we've just got to tighten our belts and lower our sights. And so it's not maybe directed specifically at research, but the research then loses the really the support that it needs to create this national progress.
Mm-hmm. You argue that recent stimulus money put into science appears to have had about the same short-term impact as funding construction projects.
That's right. I mean, there's the so-called stimulus bill, the Recovery Act of a couple of years ago, many people call it a failure. In fact, economic data show that it was a partial success. Within its own terms, it was really quite a good success. Part of that was research money. There was $22 billion that I had a hand in getting into that bill in new science research. And that stimulates the economy in a variety of ways. In the short term, you're hiring lab techs and electricians who wire the labs and that sort of thing. In the midterm, it has a multiplier effect, as any spending does. And in the long term, some of that research will pay off big. You never know. I mean, it's the nature of research that you don't know what it is that will pay off big. But I think investment in research makes good economic sense in the short term, where its effects are similar to road construction, but even more in the long term in what it brings to our quality of life and our economy.
Mm-hmm. There was some hopeful news about at least space funding this week. A bill passed by a Senate committee includes funding for the James Webb Space Telescope, and NASA rolled out plans for an even bigger rocket that it wanted to build, approaching the size of the Saturn V or bigger. Do you think that was turned around by public opinion? The public heard about things like that and maybe influenced what Congress was going to do?
I think that's possible. But, you know, we can talk about, you know, individual successes, individual programs that might be going ahead. The overall picture is that, you know, Congress is, again, if things go the way it is now prescribed to go, Congress has to find $2.4 trillion in cuts over the next 10 years. And this super committee of 12 says they might even be looking for more than that. Now, it is supposed to be saving, so it'd be a combination of new revenue mm-hmm. and cuts. But one side is saying there can be no new revenue, no tax increases, so it ends up being cuts. And so, yes, you might be able to find more money for one program or another, but the overall mm-hmm. Effort will be from the federal government will be less. And research, I think, can be expected to take at least its share, if not more than its share of hits. And as I say, you know, over the last couple of decades, it's fallen by nearly two-thirds of what it was. Or actually, this would be over the last four decades, mm-hmm. Roughly two-thirds of what it was.
You know, it didn't. Research did not get a boost this week with that the scrutiny of the Solyndra Solar Company and the $500 million federal loan on something that looked like a cutting-edge project.
Yeah. This part isn't exactly science. This is the part that is supposed to take the scientific and engineering work into practical production. Now, in that particular case, there may well have been fraud. It may have been, to some extent, just a bad gamble. But overall, this kind of underwriting of venture loans is something that pays off large. When that particular program was set up, it was expected that 10 to 20%, 14 or 15%, something like that, of the projects whose loans would be underwritten would fail. I mean, that's kind of the nature of this. So it's way too soon to say that this program is not a good use of taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. This is not the research part of it. This is the bridge across the chasm between development and production. Mm-hmm. Something related to that. Right now, it has just been introduced in Congress yesterday that to pay for the additional disaster relief expenses, FEMA and so forth, money will be taken out of the advanced vehicle program, what's known as the Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Loan Program. So, again, this is not the research in new materials, new drive systems, and so forth, new fuel efficiency. It is to turn that into practical manufacturing. That ATVM program has probably saved or created 40 or 50,000 jobs so far. So it's unfortunate that that program is where the Appropriations Committee proposes to get the money to pay for the disaster relief expenses in my state of New Jersey and in New York and Vermont and where the tornadoes went through the South and so forth.
Congressman Holt, I thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to
you. It's always good to be with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Rush Holt, who's New Jersey's 12th District Congressperson and the U.S. House of Representatives. Up next, Flora Lichtman's here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
And we're into an alternative fuel mode. You got some alternative something else there, right?
Yes. Actually, and it has a biofuel component, but it's really mostly about my favorite beat, which is wastewater processing and remediation.
Is that? Yeah, it's your favorite.
I think it's becoming my favorite.
It was mine at one point.
I'm really interested in it right now.
I almost went to graduate school in wastewater engineering because I thought it was really fascinating.
It is, and there are all these different types of solutions. So the one that we looked at in this video this week it's in Rockaway, Queens in New York, and the New York City Department of Environmental Protection has installed this sort of prototype system where they're using pond scum to purify water, basically.
Pond scum, that'd be...
I'll be more specific. I know our listeners will want to know exactly. So green algae.
Green algae. Why did you say so?
Yeah. Okay, sorry. There's this filament. Basically, the way it looks is that there are these two long ramps. They're like kind of like little slides, and they're 350 feet long, and it's all flowing downhill. And they take this water from the sewage treatment plant across the street, pump it over to these slides, and let it go down this bed of mesh, and then algae sort of naturally grows, and then the algae seems to remediate the water in some ways. So basically the algae takes out phosphorus and nitrogen and uses it to grow, and then also the dissolved oxygen content goes up a lot as it goes down this little chute. Mm-hmm. And then the water gets pumped, sort of chlorinated, and then pumped back into Jamaica Bay. So this is a very tiny...
sort of demonstration project.
It is a demonstration project, for sure. I mean, that was the thing. New York is such everything in New York is so big.
Right.
I was surprised that it was But it is neat because they're actually harvesting the algae for biofuel.
Yeah, and it's interesting is that you look at your video. It's up on our video pick of the week site up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. And it's a 300-foot, what I'd call a rain gutter, right?
It's something it's like a little low-tech, okay.
But it's long. And there's water flowing down, there's algae growing in it, right?
As the DEP person who we spoke with said, gravity works. What can I say?
Make the best use out of it. And this is a serious project to see how, you know, as I was saying, I know Aquarius, if you have an aquarium at home, you have something called a refugium. You'll know what I'm talking about if you know what I'm talking about, where you clean the water and they have algae in it.
Yeah, it's the same concept. And I think then the other thing that is neat is they're trying to maximize algae growth. And they actually have these little squeegees to harvest the algae because they're hoping that it could be used for something else. So they made their first little test bottle of biobutanol from this algae, which, you know, it's not – they have one bottle so far, so it's not going to run the plant yet. But that's the idea. Maybe you can turn this wastewater into something useful.
Yeah. Well, you can make a decision for yourself by going over to our website at sciencefriday.com. It's Flora's video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Eric.
And Flora and I will be out at the Maker Faire this week. Come see us. I'll be there tomorrow. Flora will
Sunday.
Be there on Sunday. We have a – Science Friday has a booth at Maker Faire at the New York Hall of Science out there in Queens. So we want to see you all there. Come and drop by our booth.
Say hello.
Say hello. And maybe we'll get a little prize or something out there and drop them by. That's about all the time we have for this week. Greg Smith composed our theme music. It would help from NPR librarian Kim Oleski. Our program senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata, Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. And our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. And if you missed any part of our program, go over to sciencefriday.com or download it on iTunes on our podcasts. We have audio and video podcasts. You can take them along with you. And we're tweeting all week. Yes, and you can go to our Facebook page /SciFry, and maybe we'll see you out in New York tomorrow at the New York Hall of Science out there in Queens. And we'll be in Flagstaff, on the road in Flagstaff, Arizona next week. Come on out and sit in the audience and ask some questions live. We'll see you next week in Flagstaff. We're here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Have a good weekend.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Today, a new version of Disney's The Lion King hits theaters, and this time the Circle of Life is in 3D. With the new look comes a higher ticket price. The movie industry has been banking on 3D films, and it saw this summer as the moment sales would take off. But Sammy Yenigan reports that 3D still has not lived up to its box office potential.
In 2008, the head of DreamWorks, Jeffrey Katzenberg, looked into his crystal ball and told NPR that he saw the future of movies in 3D.
This is the Polar Express!
I walked out of that theater, I came in here the next day, and I said, our lives are going to be forever changed because this is the future for us.
Katzenberg said that 3D would be like when silent films became talkies and black and whites became color. This revolution, he said, would save an industry that's seen its attendance drop 10% since 1999.
2011 was supposed to be the summer of 3D, and that just didn't turn out to be the case.
Box office analyst Jeff Bock says that despite an all-time high in box office sales this summer, people were paying more money for fewer tickets. This is now the fourth summer in a row that attendance has dropped, and that paints a grim picture for Hollywood.
Can you believe it? Us? I mean, it's the factory guys that usually get laid off. Not us. We're supposed to be safe.
With movies like Final Destination 5, Conan the Barbarian, Glee 3D, and Spy Kids 4D all coming out in August, Bock says that 3D movies haven't used what makes movies great in the first place, and that's good storytelling.
We even went to a new dimension to try to sell more tickets, and that just didn't work.
Don't make me punch your lights out.
And it's turning into a gimmick like it was in the 1980s.
The highest grossing film of all time, Avatar, got everyone excited about 3D a couple of years ago.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
But this summer's movies didn't bank the way Avatar did, says Robert Lenihan, director of programming for AMC Movie Theaters.
When you realize results, as we did with Avatar and Alice in Wonderland, if you don't continue to hit those numbers out of the park, you know, you're a little disappointed that you hadn't done as well as you had before.
The thing is, audiences have figured out that not only are a lot of the 3D movies bad, They're bad and expensive. At the AMC Lowe's Theater in Washington, D.C., it costs $11.50 to see Contagion, showing in 2D, and $15.50 to see Shark Night 3D. Kenan Marks, like everyone else outside this movie theater, is going to see Contagion. I asked Marks if he ever went to see 3D movies.
Yeah, I kind of avoid them, though, because they're usually like a lot more expensive than regular movies.
Marks says that paying extra to see something in 3D is rarely worth it.
Only if they're like made for 3D, like the Avatar movie. Otherwise, it's another way to like make more money. It's not really worth it in the end. It kind of hurts your eyes, too.
It's not all bad news for 3D. Internationally, 3D sales are doing much better than in North America. And there's still hope for domestic sales. This winter, film masters Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg are making their 3D debuts with Hugo and Tintin. Maybe these guys will make the price hike worth it for a family of four. Though that extra $16 might be better spent on popcorn. For NPR News, I'm Sammy Yenigan.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. These days, technology has become a pain, literally in the thumb, the wrist, the neck, you name it. Ergonomics experts blame too much texting and typing on tablets and other mobile devices. So we sent NPR's Joel Rose to find out how college students are coping with the strain of all their high-tech gadgets.
A generation ago, ergonomics experts only had to worry about one computer workstation per person, usually the one at the office. Now, that computer has been joined, if not replaced altogether, by a host of mobile devices. The combinations are endless and potentially problematic.
We're talking about exposure throughout a day.
Carol Stewart-Buttle is an ergonomics consultant in Philadelphia. She says each high-tech gadget presents its own problems. With the iPad, it's a touchscreen that doesn't give when you type on it, and the angle can be an issue too.
Your wrist can be really angled trying to tap away at the touchscreen. And so you've got an angled wrist, you go to work, and if your workstation isn't so great, you have more angled wrists. And if we have in the same fixed position all the time, we begin to see troubles, tendonitis formations and other effects like that.
Those effects aren't just showing up in older members of the workforce. Stewart-Buttle says she's seen the same thing with young people in college, too.
Schools with lots of papers, heavy use of computers, and their thumbs, fingers, hands all beginning to wear out a little bit.
I tried to find some of those appendages at the University of Pennsylvania in a student lounge at the Wharton School that could pass for a well-stocked Apple store. Sophomore Evan Rosenbaum says he tries to avoid typing anything longer than a quick email on his iPad.
Your wrist is definitely going to start to hurt. Being that the keyboard is too small to type with both your thumbs, but it's not big enough to type fully.
Penn Jr. Alexandra Ennie says she types on her iPad all the time.
I've had it since May 10th, it's my birthday. And I type long emails, blog posts, journal entries, and I've never had an issue. I have small fingers, though. I don't know if that makes a difference.
I did talk to a few students who suffered from pain and discomfort. Penn senior Howda Lee found it wasn't comfortable to take notes on his iPad because the screen doesn't bounce back like a normal keyboard would.
If I type for half hour, then my hand would start to kind of sore, yeah. Just uncomfortable. That's why I come by the wireless keyboard.
Lee shows me the wireless keyboard he bought to use with his iPad. Ergonomics experts like separate keyboards because ideally you want your screen and your typing surface in different places. But Carol Stewart-Buttle says one of the best things you can do to prevent repetitive stress injuries is also one of the easiest. Just take a break.
It really has to be a self-monitoring situation with all of these gadgets. Even if it's a good workstation, you still have to make sure that it's right and that you take breaks. But it's that sustained exposure that leads to trouble.
Stewart-Buttle says our gadgets may be designed to keep us connected 24/7, but our bodies aren't. Joel Rose, NPR News, Philadelphia.